tube. It had bumped around in my pack, but nothing could put a scratch on it. Once I fell asleep holding it. I had bad dreams and my forehead and cheeks were sore the next day, as though I'd spent too long in the sun. I stopped to fish one evening, hooked a pike perch, and then found 4 duck eggs in a nest. I made a fire and cooked one of them with the fish. Overhead there were cranes coming back from their winters in the south. Their long white bodies looked pink in the dying sunlight. They are holy birds to the Tungus. They use their bones as calendars and mark the phases of the moon in notches on them. The shamans say they ride them up to the 9th heaven, where the spirits live and make mischief with human souls. It's all fairy tales to me, but I did see a shaman heal a sick woman once. She was a Tungus woman who had had a stillborn child. It had left something awry in her womb. The shaman had on a heavy coat of skins with jingling metal beads on it. The beads made a map of the stars. Before there were ever books, those coats were an atlas of the skies. He danced around her body for almost an hour, until a weird web of what looked like blood appeared on the skin of his drum. I couldn't speak to the shaman myself, but I asked him questions afterward by way of a half-Tungus guide. The shaman said he felt himself rise up through the air as he drummed. The air around him became thick and watery. He claimed it was like being lost in fog, and every now and again the fog thinned, and he was aware of the breathing in the hall. Then he rose up through a final bank of cloud and landed in a clearing. He followed a path along a mountainside, past a skeleton he said was his father's, toward a lighted tent. The sick woman's body was inside it, in the shape of a pile of stones with a vine growing out of it. The shaman ripped out the tendrils of the vine. The nearer he got to the center of the plant, the thicker they got. In the middle they were a couple of inches round and furry and hot like the shaft of spring antlers full of new blood. And at the heart of the plant was a shriveled-up thing, the miscarried child whose soul had got lost on its way back from Earth. I don't know if he made this up to fool me or if he believed himself. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to my mind. But after that dance, I heard the woman was able to conceive. It seems like wherever it goes, my mind always comes back to dead children. That Tungus girls, and Pings, and mine. Mine was born dead after a 3-day labor. It was the worst pain I've ever known. In the chaos that had been brought to the city, there was not a doctor to be had. They took him away and buried him somewhere. We never mentioned it again. I was 16. I was never close to a man after that, although I think I could have been. It just wasn't how things were. My looping route toward the highway took me through a village with an old church in it. The houses around were all rotted and overgrown, but the church was solid enough, with a big wooden cupola and the bell still hanging in it. The door opened, and the air inside had a hint of incense and new whitewash. Someone called up from the cellarage in Russian. I was too amazed to recall any words of it beyond Bog, which, crazy as it seems, is what they call God. Then a man clumped up the stairs with an armful of books. He looked taken aback to see me. I couldn't have been more surprised to find a Chuchuna, and come to think of it, he resembled one a little, being tall and having a long white beard. We didn't have enough words in common to say much to each other, but we were able to talk and dumb show. He was the priest of the village, and he had a helper, a kind of junior priest called Yuri. Yuri had a beard too, but his was jet black, and he smelled strongly of onions. I'd put his age at 50 and the priest's at 75. How they'd managed to survive, just the two of them, with both weight on one side and the Tungus on the other, and keep the church in good repair, I don't know. I guess they'd just clung on there like a pair of limpets. They lived in a little house in a yard alongside the church. I put my horse in an empty stall in their barn and they fed me. We had a kind of soup of salted cabbage and some sausage, and I marked out my route to them on the tabletop. They rolled their eyes when I showed them where I was going. It was too bad that we couldn't say more. I had so many questions. After dinner, they took me down into the cellarage and showed me all the books they'd squirreled away down there. The old priest kept giving me things to hold, talking about them, and then looking at me closely as if to check I'd understood. Of course, I had no idea, but whatever it was he was talking about, he was proud of it. Yuri could see I was foxed, and he kept trying to distract him, but the old priest wouldn't be told. "Here it is," he seemed to be saying. "I've got it all squared away. Here are my jams, here are my jellies," as he dusted off another book or roll of papers. After about an hour, they locked up the church and we went back to the house. Yuri boiled up some kind of herb tea. We couldn't say anything to each other, but sitting among them felt like the first happiness I'd known for so long. I wished I had something to give them in return. Then it struck me that I did have some words in their language. I took the memory stone out of my pack, set it on the table between us, and showed them the girl from Pauline. They weren't happy until they'd seen it half a dozen times. They loved it, the old priest most of all, slapping the other on the back each time they watched it. "Люди будущего," he laughed, as though it was the best joke in the world. I was pleased to see him so lively. Then a terrible feeling came over me. I understood that he'd taken it as a picture of the present. They thought that was an image of the place as it was today. If I hadn't seen where it came from, I would have formed the same idea. Here they were in their outpost, guarding their trove of holy books, waiting for news of the outside world, and it seemed that I'd brought them good tidings. The misunderstanding made me heavy-hearted. I said to them, "You've got the wrong idea. This is the picture of the past. This girl is dead. The city looks nothing like this." But the words I was saying were just so much noise to them. They believed what they wanted to. I was the harbinger of something good. Any day now, people would begin to drift back. There would be damp beds airing out in the street. Shovels would turn over the soil in long-neglected gardens. The silent bell in the cupola would call a congregation to service, and someone would pin a medal on the old priest's chest for taking such care of his archive. They made me a bed on a ledge above their tiled stove. I told them I'd be happier on the floor, but they insisted. It was too warm and soft for me to sleep well up there, and I was troubled that I'd deceived them. Seeing what false hope had done to them lowered my spirits. The next morning they were just as cheery. They gave me buckwheat groats for breakfast and asked to watch the memory stone again. I gave the stone to the priest and told him he could keep it. He tried to press an old book on me in return, but I refused. The two of them walked me to the edge of their empty village and kissed me three times goodbye. I looked back half a dozen times and they were still there, watching me go. Spring was on the land. There was no snow to be seen anywhere. One hot noontime I decided to bathe. I tethered the horse and stripped at the edge of the stream. My feet were so pale they looked bluish. Although the river was shallow, it was swollen and faster than it looked. I almost took a tumble as I stepped in. I braced my legs against a rock as the current eddied around my knees, then squatted down to let the water wash all over me. The cold made my head ring. After I'd got myself clean, I laundered my clothes on a rock and then left them to dry in the sun. I lay on the bank, soaking up the heat like a lizard, fighting the urge to drift off, but the sound of the river lulled me to sleep. I must have slept for an hour or more, because I woke up groggy, with my vision all bleached out from the sunshine. It took me a moment or two to come to my senses. There's the horse munching green shoots off a tree. There's my damp clothes. Here's me naked with dried mud up to my ankles that looks like a pair of socks. And suddenly, over the sound of the river running, I heard a buzz, very, very faint but growing stronger. Up in the eastern part of the sky, maybe a quarter of a mile up, was the silver glint of a plane. I stood there naked, shouting myself hoarse and waving my clothes as she passed overhead. Judging from the angle of her flight, it seemed like she'd come out of the far north, maybe from Alaska. By the time I thought to fire my gun, the plane was in the southwest part of the sky. I loosed off 4 or 5 signal shots, but she gave no sign of hearing me. The bullets would have been barely more than faint pops above the sound of the engine. The plane slipped away into the deep blue of the sky like a tiny silver fish. But as she vanished over the trees behind me, I was certain I knew where she was headed. Chapter 3. It took me 2 days to reach the base. I rode like a madwoman. I don't recall that I ate at all. Sometimes I'd dismount and walk alongside the horse to let her rest. All that time I could hear my heart banging in my chest with hope. Seeing that plane the first time at the lake, I'd never known hope like it. I was a castaway. The plane was a sail, luffing and snapping to a new course as it came to find me. I would walk on its warm deck with my pretty feet. There was silk and cloves in its hold, coconuts, oranges. Well, I guess it brought on the hooey in me. There's a little in there. I am a woman. The second plane gave me a different kind of joy. This time it was the cavalry. It was the law in armor. I pictured it touching down on the base like a twister, ripping the huts out of the ground, scything down the guards. Imagine those captives free and bent on revenge. They'd kill Boathwaite like a dog and scorch his slave camp to the roots. I neared the base around noon and dismounted where the forest began to thin. The land around the walls was bare. It had been clear cut in the early days for timber and to strip the cover from the approach. I hung back out of sight behind a stand of trees. My first glimpse of the base was through the spyglass. I could see the mismatched tiles on the roofs beyond the palisade and smoke rising from the smithy and the cookhouse. The wind brought the hum of the latrines across the open ground. Everything looked more small and grubby than I remembered. My eye was jaded after the marvels of Pauline, but it's also because the snow was gone. Snow flatters poor workmanship. It covers up dirt and makes the crooked look quaint, and it keeps things from stinking. I started to make a circuit of the base, keeping close behind the fringe of trees. There were no men to be seen, but just beside the front gate, no more than 20 yards outside the walls, stood the plane. What a beautiful thing it was, like a muscle or a blade, all purpose. There was a ripple of heat haze above its top wing that made it look like it was still in motion. As nearly as I could remember, it was the same kind as the one that had gone down by the lake. The colors of its hull were red and white, and it had a door in its tail like the one I'd smashed open that time on the hillside. It had a weathered look. The dents and patches on the wings hinted at the labor it took to keep it flying. And yet, I could scarcely believe that the creatures who made that thing were human. Everything at the base had a handprint on it. Everything took its scale from the shape of a man and the work he could do in one day. I could judge with my eye how long it would take to raise a stretch of wall or level a simple road that ran around it. I could probably name every tool they used to build it. But to make that plane, was it 6 months? Or a century? What mysteries were at work in its engine? It looked as out of place standing on that bleached grass as the wristwatch had on the herder's arm. I am in awe of this broken pianola and the nameless craftsman who fitted it with brass wires and felted hammers and a spiked drum to read the piano rolls. I've saved these piles of books for the knowledge that's in them. I've seen Pauline. I marvel daily on my morning rides at the beautiful skeleton of my dead city. But to turn words and numbers into metal and make them fly? What bigger miracle can there be? It's a kind of heresy to say so, but I think our race has made forms more beautiful than what was here before us. Sometimes God's handiwork is crude. There is no more ugly thing than a lobster. There is not much pretty about a caribou. It has an ungainly walk, and its touch hole voids droppings when it strains in harness. Was there a straight line on earth before we drew one? But that plane in flight didn't pump and lurch like a big bird does. It moved steady and level and faster than any bird I've ever seen. The truth is, I half expected its crew to be gods. And what would they know of us? What had they seen from the sky? What would men like that make of the brutal facts of our life at the base? I thought they would feel about me the way I felt about the simple understanding of the Tungus, with their shamans and spirits and Chuchuna. I rode back into the bush to wait that night and ponder. I am rash by nature. I act best in the heat of the moment. Given too long to think, I can fall to brooding. More for company than anything practical, I set a small fire and fed it with long, slim twigs, holding on to the ends of them until they were almost consumed by the flame. A dry wind blew and fanned the embers to orange. Over the years since I'd seen the first plane, it had become my North Star. Just knowing about it was a comfort to me. I'd touched its hull with my own hands. I'd buried what was left of its crew. I'd poured all my wishes into it. It was a vessel that held everything my world was not. But now that it came to dealing with the living, breathing people that were on this new one, my nerve had failed. All sorts of bewildered feelings were stirred up inside me. Part of me was dying to know more, but another noisy part was saying that it was better to leave now, knowing the first one wasn't a fluke, and not go further, which was bound to lead to ugliness and disappointment. Big as the plane looked to me, hope was too heavy a cargo for it to carry. I still wonder if there could have been anything on the plane that would have made what I'd gone through seem worthwhile. It's so hard to think now what might have been on it instead of what was. What happens lays down a steel track over all the flimsy forms of what might have been. I've been around this many times. I see myself in the wood, feeding the twigs into my solitary fire. And I see the empty plane sleeping by the gates of the base. I move myself like a picture on a memory stone until I'm riding backward to Pauline, giving Shamsuddin the kiss of life on the way, trudging backward to the base with Tolly and the prisoners, the years of confinement, the months of work returning Bothwaite's garden to a wilderness. Back and back I go, to before Ping's death, to when the city had life in it. To before the bad years, until I'm standing at the Bering Sea with my father, watching the Chukchi pack the innards back into a walrus and set him adrift on the water. And at each moment I think, here or here? Is this the choice that set the points for what followed? Whatever way I come at it, it always plays out the same. The bad thing happens. The city burns. Those I love die. The plane crashes. I search for another. And when I finally find one, it has Eben Callard on it. Chapter 4. He was older, of course, yet somehow that surprised me. and even after spending some time with him, I found that his face was still overlaid by the younger one that I had spent so many hours remembering. "I knew a Makepeace once," he said. He snapped his fingers for someone to pour him a drink. The blind can have a bossy way about them. I lied and told him that I was from a different city. He sat in the chair behind Bothwaite's tin desk, wearing a dark broadcloth suit, staring straight past me with those cloudy eyes. His shirt was white and newly pressed. "Your voice is familiar," he said. "It must be that settler accent." He never gave any hint that he might have known me. "Bothwaite spoke highly of you." I still had the dust on me from my long ride. Six of his men were posted around the room. They were armed. Two wore bandoliers. They'd patted me down for weapons when I'd come in. At dawn, I had ridden up to the gates. The itch to know had overcome any thought I had for my own safety. If I'd had any inkling who'd been on it, of course, I would have made for home. But I never connected that plane with anything in my own past. In my mind, it came out of the orderly world of my parents with a promise as straight and green as the twig in that dove's beak. Dry land this way. Turn your ship around. The sentry knew me by sight, but another man, one of Eben Callard's, it turned out, was standing guard beside him. They called someone out of the guardhouse to take the horse. I didn't know the boy. There was straw in his hair and his face was crinkled from sleep. I was sorry to see the horse go. There was no easy way out of there without her, but my desire to know about the plane had overmastered my every other thought. All the omens were poor. The sentry gave me a sly and uneasy look as he hauled the door open. And on the far side of the parade ground, a rough wooden cross had been dug into the dirt, and off it was dangling a body. The wind had sprung up, and when it blew, it caught him like a sail and made the joints of the crosspiece creak. Though the face was black and swollen, I could see from his build that it was Bothwaite. There were wounds to his body and head, and his arms had been nailed through the wrists. His belly was all bloated with gas. From the manner of his death, I guessed the prisoners had chosen it themselves. He looked like he'd been dead at least 2 days. They must have turned on him in a fit of revenge soon after the plane landed. I'll confess, I was taken aback. I'm no lover of mob justice. People making their own law is an ugly sight. Shamsuddin had said that civilization meant city life. I wasn't sure about that. To me it meant streetlights, plumbing, schools, and things worked out by reason. I can't see the reason in deliberate cruelty. It makes a fetish of what's most base in us. But I had to trust that the men in the plane were wise enough to know what they were about. No one else had died. The walls were intact. The place had not been razed. Maybe the body on the cross was the price of that order. Whatever upsets there had been, I still held my own rank as a guard. My room was just as shabby as I'd left it. The dust on the window looked like milled gold in the sunlight. Out of the window, I watched the place coming to life. First the reveille and the weary prisoners dragging their chains out of the bunkhouse. How ragged they looked. After 15 minutes, one of the new guards came in and said Mr. Callard would see me. By the time I reached the office, I had a pretty good idea what I'd find. On the walk over, his man said to me that he'd lost his eyes defending a woman's honor. That made me smile. The first meeting was short. He wanted to know where I'd been, how come I'd survived. I told him as little as possible. They excused me to go back to my room and clean up. Someone brought food and water and a change of clothes. They gave me a rough towel with a tablet of green soap on it. I scrubbed myself and cleaned my hair with it in the washroom. I could only think that it had come on the plane. It had been so long since I'd seen any. We used to make our own in Evangeline. Fat and lye, is what you use to do it. Jezebel. There was a little scent in this one. It seemed to make my hair go stringy. As I washed, I thought of how I would escape. First light. I'd take another horse. I'd take two. Tears made my eyes go blurry. It was the disappointment of it. After all this, I was the one holding a garbled message. I thought I was a caretaker, shoring up the few things I could against annihilation, trying to be worthy of the traditions of my ancestors. I'd always been so proud that I lived in this world. But I was just like Pa. I needed another world to redeem the present. I've looked back at my pages and found I've written, "I don't need things to be otherwise." You know how it is when the most cussed and determined bachelor falls in love, he colors what's left of his hair and gets his heart broken? Or the teetotal lady who does the flowers in the church has her first sherry at 60 and dies a drunk? I'd walk through life like a cat on ice, testing each step before I took it. Now it turned out I'd tiptoed into a bear trap. It's something when disaster walks in through an open window. But what could you do? Every life has some of that. But when you barred yourself into a strongbox, rubbed your hands, and spent years telling everyone how safe you are, that's the trouble I'm talking about. Everyone sees it coming but you. That's in the nature of a blind spot. The years stretched off in front of me like a frozen winter road. The hope that I'd fed on, that I'd held in secret like a stash of hidden money, was gone. How had I lived before Ping or the plane, without the sense that any other life was mortis to mine, or the thought that somewhere children were walking to school and the dead getting buried and the pianola playing in tune, sitting in the dark all winter waiting for the candles to run out, trying to catch an echo of the life that had been here, waking in the dark, cleaning my guns at night, crunching out to the stable with a saddle over my shoulder. My life didn't even count as suffering. It was one long, cruel joke that the wind had written on the snow. Chapter 5. There was an odd smell in the air, which I remarked on to the guards who came to get me toward midday. They said the stills were going full tilt to brew fuel for the plane. It meant the kitchens were shorthanded and most of the inmates on half rations. I questioned the wisdom of that privately. For all his shortcomings and cruelties, Boathwaite never let the prisoners go hungry. The food was often dull, but it was plentiful. He'd known, as well as I did, that well-fed people were more biddable. They escorted me across the parade ground. I knew the way as well as they did, but I guessed they'd been told to keep a close eye on me. Up in the fields, the men were laboring as slowly as ever, weeding and mending fences, grumbling and moving livestock. Things looked much like they always had, and yet some odd changes had taken place in my absence. With Boathwaite and Tolia dead, the running of the base had fallen to a man named Purefoy. He was settler stock himself, but a shy man who I'd always felt Boathwaite trusted because he didn't have the dash and swagger of a natural leader or carry much weight with the other guards. Empty bellies, the old boss gone. There was more than the fumes from the stills in the air. I was almost too cast down to smell it, but sure enough, alongside the stink of brewing and the dirt and the latrine, there was a sharp whiff of mutiny. They had laid out Boathwaite's room for a banquet. I didn't feel like eating anymore. Purefoy and a half dozen of the senior guards were there. They had shaved and put on their best coats, and three or four of them had brought their wives. You could see by the way the men bowed and scraped to Evan Callard and his men that they felt themselves to be country cousins. The women sat by themselves at a separate table, wearing old-fashioned formal clothes. I couldn't help wondering about Boathwaite's widow and that little girl of his. There was a place laid for me at the main table. Eben Callard sat at the head of it, and there were 14 or so places set round it. Much of the food had come from the base, but there was plenty there that must have traveled with them on the plane, since we had no way of growing or making it there. There was sweet wine for the women, little heaps of orange salmon eggs, bowls of lump sugar, candy and canned crab meat, and bottles of cognac with labels on them. At a signal from one of the guards, we took our seats. It was a strained and nervy gathering. No one was sure if we were meant to start eating. Eben Callard rolled a shot glass of cognac between his fingers. "We don't visit often," he said. "We don't want to leave a bad impression. Things have had to be done. Some harsh decisions had to be made. But I don't want to dwell on that now." He was speaking of Boathwaite. Even now his body was tanning in the sunshine out in the yard. I wondered what they considered to be his crime. He must have run the base as they asked him, turning the raw prisoners into farmhands and sending gangs of them out to the zone to scavenge from Pauline. Maybe he'd been a little softer in command than they wanted? Had he failed to bring enough back from the zone? Or was it some lingering politics that I had no sight of, like what had seen me imprisoned by Boathwaite's brother? I guessed that whatever happened here was a sideshow to the world Eben had flown out of. Maybe his standing there hinged on his adventures here in the north. I knew now that on the other side of the straits something limped on. It hadn't abandoned us. In fact, it seemed to look to us for its salvation. My mind was snapped back to the room by his mentioning the zone. His white, sightless eyes had fixed on me at the end of the table. "The last trip threw up some promising things. We're looking forward to learning more before we leave." He proposed a toast and put his glass to his lips, the level in it barely altered while all around the table the guards emptied theirs. Purefoy proposed a toast in return. People began eating, the drinking became general and loosened the mood in the room. The guard next to me served me with roasted meat from a tray. I remembered him as a bully. Flushed with drink, he boasted of his young wife and whispered indiscreetly about what I'd missed. "They gave him a last chance 1 year ago. That's when they sent the Jap out from Alaska." He nodded his head at Apafagato, who sat up at the far end of the table. "He'd been to the zone himself," he said. "Trouble was, Boathwaite was too damn soft. A dozen or so prisoners a year would never make a dent in that place. They needed to turn the whole base out, march them into the zone en masse." When he said soft, I thought of the pile of the bodies in the snowmelt on the bridge. "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs," he said. The afternoon dragged on. The bottles kept coming. I didn't drink, and neither did Eben Callard. By mid-afternoon, the noise in the room was a roar. Men took turns making outlandish toasts. The guards' wives were flushed and giggly. Suddenly, Eben Callard's voice cut through the buzz of drunken laughter. "We haven't heard from Makepeace," he said. I said I didn't mean to give offense, but I'd drunk as much as I wanted. The room quietened. He said he hadn't had a toast in mind. He'd wanted to hear me speak about the zone and what we'd found there. So I told them what I'd seen, more or less, leaving out my own visit to the city. I told them about the Tungus boy and the poison and how we shot the prisoners on the bridge. That phrase, "too soft," that the man next to me had used kept coming into my head. I told them about Zulfugar and the soft-nosed bullet that had cored him like an apple. I wanted them all to know, the women too, since it was done in their name, and I told them that we'd come back empty-handed. They heard me out politely and without interest, as if these were things that we didn't speak of but were plain to all of us. When I was done speaking, Eben Callard thanked me for my account of the trip.
"Sure you've been straight with us?" he said.
I told him I had.
"Because some of my men followed your trail into the bush and went digging."
He signaled, and someone brought a sack into the room.
I knew what was in it. I'd buried it near the ashes of the fire the night before.
Eben Callard reached in and pulled out the mason jar with its waves of light. He held it up with both hands as though he was going to bless it. The room went quiet enough that you could hear the faint hum of all that light moving.
"I wish I had eyes to see it," he said, "because I hear it's a pretty thing."
Chapter 6. Why Eben Callard needed to make theater out of proving me a liar, I don't know. But after he had his men take me down to a room in the courtyard where they left me for a while, bound fast, before they hauled me out to question me. They took me to another room with shades over the windows, where in spite of the heat of the day they had a stove lit, which they'd rake from time to time with pokers, with a plain intention of letting me think they were going to burn me. They said they wanted to know why I'd lied and where the thing had come from and why I had hid it, but the truth was, I think they were just itching to knock me around the place. One of them stepped forward with a roll of papers which he spread out in front of me. "I want you to look carefully at these drawings and tell me if any of the things the prisoners found are shown on it."
There were 6 sheets of thin waxy paper with drawings on them in a kind of faint blue ink. The pictures were drawn with a very exact hand, and measurements and figures were inked in alongside them. There was writing in Russian, too, but I couldn't read it. Some of the images I could recognize. There were suits and masks like the guards had been wearing, something that resembled a rifle, but others were simply too strange for me to make head or tail of. I shook my head in a weary way and told them that all we'd found was the flask, and they had that. They let me alone to sleep, and around noon the next day there was a knock on the door and someone slid in a plate of food. It was sausage, stale bread, and beetroot soup. I recognized the sausage as leftovers from our feast. It had grown more leathery and little drops of oil had gathered on its cut ends. The door opened again and 2 guards showed Eben Callard to the spare seat in the room. "Make sure her hands are tied," he said. The guards roped my arms to the chair and yanked the cord tight. They left the room at a signal. The shutting of the door seemed loud over the silence that followed. Being alone with him after all that time wasn't as strange as you'd think. "How do you look, Makepeace? They tell me you're marked."
"I look about the same," I said. "What happened to your eyes?"
"You want the long answer or the short one?"
I told him I didn't mind either.
He passed his hand over the tabletop in a steady, thorough way until it lighted on the handle of the spoon. With his other, he found the soup bowl. Then he stirred it up until the broth went cloudy like his sightless eyes. Before Evangeline, you know, we had a big property outside of Esso. That was the place we left America for. It was really something. The earth's volcanic and rich, and there are hot springs right under the city. You just sink a pipe and you've got hot water. We had heated greenhouses, tomatoes all year. We were on the side of a mountain you could ski down, and only a couple of 100 miles from Peter Paul. He sighed with the recollection of it.
"And I bet you thought life was good in Evangeline."
"Then all the changes came. We got overrun. There were Russians and Evenki and some Koreans who had been there from the beginning. They formed a militia and kicked everyone else out. They didn't care if we had a title to the land.
The For the next 5 years, it was all snakes and ladders, with no ladders. First run out of Esso, then run out of Evangeline by James Hatfield's people. You know that we lit out of there with nothing? A bunch of men came to our house with torches. They said someone had raped James Hatfield's girl, and I was supposed to have done it. I offered to go out and talk to them, but my father said not to. It was the middle of the night. There was no reasoning with them. They'd have strung me up there and then. While we were arguing about what to do, they set the roof on fire. We grabbed what we could and escaped out the back. It was my 19th birthday. I should be bitter about it, but I'm not, because that was the start of all the good things that happened to me. He kept stirring, sifting through the contents of the bowl in silence. Then he let the spoon drop. We had to set out for Magadan on foot. It was summertime. I don't know how we stayed alive on that highway. The things I saw made life in Evangeline seem like Sunday school. A couple of times we skipped off the road and traveled in the taiga, getting eaten alive by the insects. We got a ride part of the way with a trader, a Jew from Odessa called Eli Rosenbaum, who was on his way back from Poling. We were lucky to find him. He drove us through the worst of it. You know what a vizdikhod is? He had one of those, with its cab piled up to here with weapons, guns and things I'd never seen before. There were roadblocks in those days, but they were built to stop foot traffic. Eli drove at night, and whenever he came across one, he'd floor the thing and crash right through it. He helped us on a boat to Providence, what the Russians called Providenia, that little pinch point between the old world and the new. Only a handful of miles, but every time you come this way over it, it costs you a day. He warned us about going there. We told him we were planning on paying some Chukchi to take us across to Nome. My mother had family in Barrow if we could get there. Before he left us, he gave my father a pistol to protect himself. The voyage took 2 weeks. You ever been to Providence? It's a hellhole. There used to be a fleet there, but they'd all been discharged. The town was crawling with hungry sailors looking for money, looking for a way back west. Ugly, stained buildings. The Chukchi were terrified of the Russians and wouldn't come near the place. There was one warehouse full of freeze-dried potatoes that had been rations for the fleet. A gang of sailors were selling it off. We paid them a pair of gold earrings for enough to feed 4 of us. It was stupid of us, but we were desperate. They marked us out as worth robbing. We hunkered down that night in an abandoned apartment. We were asleep when some sailors broke in and started to beat up my father. In the struggle, the pistol rolled out of his pocket and I let off 3 shots at them. They were homemade shells. The first 2 killed one of the sailors. The 3rd blew up in the breach and the metal splinters took one of my eyes out. The noise of it scared them out of there. We left town as soon as we could and went on foot to a Chukchi village on the Bering Sea. My father clung on for a few days. My mother gave the Chukchi all we had to take us across to Diomede. You know there are Chukchi on Diomede? Like us, neither Russian nor Yankee. We buried my father at sea. Just slipped his body into the water. We felt it was better that way. We didn't want him to lie in foreign soil. What I would have given to bury him in America. We were near enough Alaska to be able to smell it, but with no way to get there. The Chukchi on Diomede gave us a shack, and my mother taught in their school for a while. But it was tough on us, losing our dad, losing our home, stranded among savages. No disrespect to them, they couldn't have been kinder to us, but we didn't come to that place to live like that, all the dirt and drunkenness. You know how native people are. The straits were still icing up some winters. I remember my first sight of sea ice on the foreshore looking out toward Alaska. It looked unreal through my one good eye, flat as a painting, all that mist and sand and gray water. I swore to God that if he could find us a way to get there, I would be his servant in everything. That was the day everything changed. I went back to the shack, and who's there but Eli Rosenbaum? He'd run into some Chukchi fishermen who'd told him about us, and he'd come to help. He paid gold for us to get to Nome, and found a boat there to take us on to Barrow. Waking up that first morning in Barrow was like coming round from a bad dream. I mean, it wasn't like it was, but compared to everything we'd seen. Waffles and fruit for breakfast. I never tasted anything so good in my whole life. My aunt said her sourdough starter was 100 years old. I looked at my mother with my mouth open when she said that. As bad as they thought things were to have that continuity. Through the winter, Eli came back every couple of months to check on us. He was back and forth to Chukotka and brought us news. Soon it became pretty obvious to even me that he wasn't just visiting out of neighborliness. He'd taken a shine to my mother and was courting. Our relatives weren't keen on it, with him being a Jew and everything. But my mother was a widow, and she didn't have any better offers. She wouldn't hear anything against it, and she liked to tell them it wasn't the first time he'd sent a Jew to save us. They were married in the spring, and I went to work with Eli. Eli had a business going up here. He'd take moonshine and bullets and whatnot, and pay Tunguz to go into the zone for him and fetch weapons and tools. He'd bring them back to Alaska to sell. Dealers came up in private planes from all over to see him. They had a notion where he was getting it from and bitched about his prices, but none of them could have done what he did. I started traveling out with him. I know the far north like you do. I understand the mind of the Tunguz. Eli came to depend on me. We were able to clean out whole sections of Pauline and get the stuff back to the States, but every time it got harder and harder to get labor. The Tunguz were getting sick and dying, and they'd refuse to go. Each time we'd have to tap up another village. The Tunguz there still hate us for what happened in the early days. We started to think there must be an easier way to do this. There were all these masses of people dying for food, and there's us hurting for workmen. That's when we stumbled on this place. It was an old garrison. We stocked it with men, and twice a year we send them in to earn their living. I took them myself at first. I never went into the zone itself, but I liked being near it. Radiation didn't bother me at all, but that other stuff? That's fierce. We couldn't risk that getting out of there. The first couple of times we brought them back to the base. So many people got sick, we had to kill everyone and start again. We didn't like doing it. We didn't do it lightly. But we can't get by without what we get from the zone. It's as plain as that. It's not pretty what we do, but I'm not ready to ask my wife and family to live like the Tunguz. And to be honest about it, most of these prisoners will never see the zone. There's old men here who would have been dead years ago without the base. We give them food, we give them work. If you take away the years they've gained from the years that had been lost, I'd guess it comes out all square.
He was silent for a while.
"And how did you lose the other one?" I asked him.
He shifted in his chair.
"That one's a cataract. Too much staring at the sun. But I can see enough in it to know who you were. The thing about the zone is, over the years, the easy pickings have gone. It's getting harder and harder to find what we want, yet the best stuff is supposed to still be in there. things that make the flask you found look like a slingshot, and medicines, cases of cells, Daniel's fire. That's why I sent Apophagato out. But Bothwaite picked this moment to go soft on me. I wondered if, because I was someone from his own past, he felt the need to acquit himself in front of me. I stayed quiet and let him open himself out to the silence in the room. He wanted to wind it up. Marriage and having kids made me more of a fighter. I need to be out here laying my skinny ass on the line so that they can live like they ought to. But it made Bothwaite soft. Marriage for him meant sitting in his garden with his wife and daughter eating ice cream. For a second, Eben seemed to hear a voice in his head accusing him of cruelty, some echo of his conscience stirring, and he flashed angrily at it. I don't say I like it, but I do it, and I go home and my wife don't know, nor will my kids. I do it so they won't have to. It's not a choice between good and bad. It's a choice between what is and what might be. The slick words I remembered from before. Always a plan. Always a way to talk something into its opposite. But as I watched him, I was struck for the first time by a doubt about him against all the evidence of my memory, what I knew of him, or seemed to know. It's easy to look smart, less easy to do good. You can only live in the world you find yourself in. These prisoners are fed because of me. There are cities with a future across the water because of what I've done. That seemed to satisfy his conscience. I remembered his changeable moods. Suddenly he was reflective. You wonder, where does the time go? It seems like suddenly you're old and the years are driving on, merciless. I can't pretend the world we have is a match for what was. We live very simple, don't get the wrong idea, from the plains. There's things we don't know anymore, things we don't have, things we can't make. Our settler parents, what they did was easy. But out of the chaos they left us, I am trying to make something. It's an awful duty, you know, taking care of the future. Who on earth would have thought it would fall to me? Don't be so bashful, I told him. I can't think of anybody better. This world has your handprints all over it. So far I had heard him out in silence. All that ancient history between us meant nothing to me. I knew thousands of people had stories worse than his. But he wasn't dumb. He could hear the hatred in my voice. I never laid a finger on you, Makepeace, he said. I've done some ugly things. I'm the first to own it. But I'm innocent of that. He fixed me with the blown bulbs of his eyes. It wasn't me. But I don't blame you for believing it was, because the truth is uglier than you can imagine. Suddenly my old tired body ached from all its rough usage, and I wished I had something stronger than soup to drink. Remember Rudy Velasquez? Eben went on. About 5 years ago he showed up in Alaska and looked me up at my office. I hadn't heard from him for years, but I recognized his name and I had him shown in. There were a few niceties, this and that, how so-and-so, you know how it is. But I'm a busy fellow, so I asked him what was his reason for wanting to see me. He told me he was sick. I'd known that as soon as I'd heard his voice. He was old and papery, and shaking his hand was like holding a fistful of sticks. Now, as it happens, I know a good doctor in Barrow, and I was pleased it was this, because, generally speaking, what people want is to borrow money from me, or for me to find work for them. I told him I'd be happy to help and was ready to have him seen out,
when he said that it wasn't that he was after and he'd like to have a word with me in private. Now, that's something I rarely do. I'm still pretty quick, and I'd back myself against any man in a grapple, but without my sight, I am at a disadvantage. I have to be careful how I do business. So I had him patted down again and sent my bodyguards out of the room. There was a long silence. I told him I was pressed for time. Still, nothing. Finally, he blurted it out. He said he wanted me to forgive him. He said I'd taken the blame for something he'd done. I told him not to mind it. The past never weighed on me that heavy in any case. And besides, I couldn't imagine Rudy doing anything so bad it could stir his conscience.
I knew otherwise, but I said nothing.
Rudy said this thing had been preying on his mind. He was keen for me to know in detail, and whether I forgave him or not, that was up to me. Confession's a powerful thing. He said it was him that had broken into the Hatfield residence that night with a gang of men he'd hired down by the old firehouse. He'd had to pay them half up front to get a deal, and they were drunk when he went to meet them. He had a bad feeling about it, but he went ahead anyway. The men were out of control. He lost a grip on things as soon as they got to the house. You know the rest. I told him it was your forgiveness that he needed, but for my part, I could see his remorse was genuine and it wasn't up to me to judge him. He seemed pretty happy with that answer and left soon afterward. It didn't rest so easy there with me, though. It didn't feel quite right. I knew Rudy once, and it didn't sound like the kind of thing he would do. We have all had to adapt, but for Rudy to break in and steal? It got to bothering me so much that I had some of my men follow him. They said he was living with some distant relative of his in a street full of crippled houses that were sliding into their own foundations. He spent most of each day in bed in the screwed-up room, not a straight angle left in it, coughing up into a bucket. So finally, I went to see him. I said, "Rudy, something's bothering me about the story you told. And don't for a second think that I don't forgive you, because I do. And in a way, I ought to thank you, for if they'd never run me out of town, perhaps I would have never made it here like I have." And I thought to myself, maybe it would have been me in this crooked room preparing to die. "But what's bothering me is this. I just don't believe that you, on your own, would have decided to rob James Hatfield." And he said in his rattling voice, "I didn't." "If that's the case, why did you do it?" "Someone sent me," he said. "And who was that?" I asked. "James Hatfield." For a moment, I thought I'd misheard, or the consumption had reached his brain. But then, just after, it was like a big light going on in my head. "What do lawyers say?" Eben went on. "Cui bono?" "We got set up. Your father was running out of friends. Turning the other cheek sounded grand, but it wasn't practical. He knew that, but how could he climb down from his mountaintop and say he'd changed his mind, a man as rigid as him? A wiser man would have known how to move with the times. He could have thrown his hands up and said, 'I was wrong, this thing's out of control, Mike Callard has the right idea. We need to arm ourselves and protect what we have here.' But the thing about your old man is, he had no humility. He had to be right, even when he was wrong. And what made it galling for him was my father, a newcomer to the town who'd depended on your father's charity, winning over all those wavering souls. Your father must have wrestled with himself, seeing the corner he was in. Yes, he had an uncomfortable choice to make. Rudy said your father came to him and laid things out. He told him he needed a provocation. Rudy was supposed to break into your house with a gang of men, rough the place up a bit. No one was to be harmed, just smash up this and that. Enough for him to blame us for it, run us out of town, and use it to excuse a change of heart on carrying arms. I can almost hear your father's voice saying it.